Hi, welcome to Dissecting Dharma, part 5 of 5. This is a Hellbound Horror Festival. This is the wrong introduction. This is a Hellbound Horror Podcast episode. I can't remember the number, but you'll find it out on the notes.
Are you happy with this?
I'm happy with that intro, yeah.
Okay. So, first of all, we're going to start with talking about episode 9, The Bogeyman.
Okay, the bogeyman or the boogeyman, depending on which country you're from, it's the same thing.
Technically, I think it is pronounced bogey.
Okay, bogey. Like that.
First things first, we need to do a correction. I say we. You need to do a correction or apology. You noted that the wrong state in the last episode.
I said Michigan, didn't I?
Or Minnesota. I don't even know what you
Michigan,
said.
I said Michigan, yeah.
But the apartment was actually in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Sorry, people of Michigan, you didn't have Dharma in your presence.
You didn't, no. So should we go straight into
Absolutely. It? Absolutely. So, episode 9, what is the title of episode 9?
I've just said it.
Okay.
You forgot?
I forgot.
What is it?
Jesus, Dharma, Picky Nose or something?
The Bogeyman!
Vicky just put her finger up her nose to show me.
She did, yeah. The episode opens in the Columbia Correction Facility.
Yeah.
Is it Portage? Is that how you pronounce it? Probably not. Wisconsin. Dharma's in line to collect his post. That's where it opens. Do you remember that?
I do remember that, yeah.
He makes jokes with the prison officer about putting in a request for cyanide capsules and a razor blade. Can you check on that for me?
Yeah. And this is when the cult of Dharma really begins, isn't it?
Yes. He gets letters, doesn't he, from loads of people. The one that we hear about is from a young female fan. And does he see, like, Halloween costumes and comics all about himself?
That's right. Someone's made a really dark and sinister comic-related Dharma publication.
Yeah, and this person also sent $5 in the post to him.
That's right, yeah, so he can use it as commissary.
Yeah, and she asks for something back, and so he draws around his hand and sends it to Alice.
Yeah, I think Alice the superfan wanted a signed drawing.
Superfan. Yeah, it's they are sycophantic, aren't they?
Yeah.
Again, you see him in prison. He has no affiliation with any other inmates there. He's alone, again, talking to himself. He just makes bad jokes with them. I think he's trying to, like, goad them a little bit. The inmates don't like him. It's just not very pleasant, is it, really?
No, it's...
So you see him in general population.
Yeah.
Then we cut away from the prison and go and see Glenda. So Glenda's trying to finally return back to the apartment. Do you remember you're surrounded by the news vans?
Oh, my God, yeah, and she had the word... This is like, obviously she's not a victim in the classic sense, but she is by proxy with living close to him, and the effect that Dharma's presence and his life has had upon her is really evil.
Yeah. You see, she returns back and is haunted, isn't she, by the smells and stuff, and the daughter's obviously concerned about her, but she hasn't got anywhere else to go, so that's the only option.
What did you think of this episode?
It was good. To be honest, I'm going to be brutally honest with you. Obviously, we watched these two, and then I watched, like, a bit more and learned a bit more. So I'll delve into that a bit later.
Okay.
Let's stick to plan.
Okay.
So... You go back then, so again, it's the backwards-forward storytelling. He pays the prison officer for a tape player.
Yeah.
And he listens to... What did he listen to, Al?
I can't remember. What
whale calls.
To. That's right, whale sounds, whale singing.
Really loudly.
Just so he can go to sleep.
Yeah, he said he finds it soothing, he can't sleep.
And what does the police officer think it is? He thinks it's some sort of sick thing. He doesn't realise it's whale calls.
I don't know. Well, it's quite unusual, isn't it, really, to hear it in a prison?
Yeah, he thinks he's a sicker. Calls him a sicker when he takes the tapes off him.
He's doing... He also, in this point, he says that he's doing 900 years. 900 years is his term.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
And he wanted the electric chair, that's what he says. And then you skip to Tony's mum. So Tony's mum receives an unauthorised biography.
Yeah. That's right, yeah.
And was asked to sign it.
Was it the comic?
I don't... A lot of this program does, like, you get like snippets of things and you're supposed to like automatically understand exactly what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, who wrote it? I don't know who wrote it. I don't actually think it means it matters. Yeah. It's just the fact that this person, the mother of a victim, is being like plagued by super fans, really.
Mm-hmm.
But who are fans of, you know, a murder victim. It's just bizarre, isn't it, really?
It really is bizarre, yeah.
She then, I think, seeks legal advice, and she wants to sue the city and Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
And Lionel is bringing a book out called Where Did I Go Wrong?
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
You know,
he's trying to do a good thing through his book, isn't he?
Yeah, the lawyer is pressing Tony's mum to sue Lionel as well, but she doesn't actually want to sue him because she, I suppose, feels for him.
Feels that he's a victim as well, being the father.
Yeah, and then you switch to seeing Dharma actually watching Lionel being interviewed on telly. Right, yeah. It's really surreal.
The whole thing's surreal. I don't want to say what happens in episode 10, but it's surreal what's happening around this as well at the same time.
Yeah, it's just, there's a lot of hype around and, you know, exposure and coverage and media and lawyers and, you know, this council and the city and the police. Like, it's all just, all so much from one person's actions.
Exactly, yeah.
You know, it's, you feel it, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
There's the family of the Laotian victim, Conorak Synthesymphone, who was the 13th victim. There's quite a lot that's played out about, you know, the nightmare that the surviving brother that was also assaulted has. You know, the family refused to say his name. Like, there's so much. That family was really tormented and tortured by Dharma's actions.
Yeah, really torn apart, really, completely.
Yeah, visceral, wasn't
and
it?
And you can't see any signs of closure for them at all.
No, it's just heartbreaking.
Yeah.
And you only, I think it's by viewing the victims' families that you really get a sense of how devastating it all is.
Yeah.
And then it does switch to a lavish dinner for the police. Like, they're having a do for something.
They're actually awarding some sort of hero award to the two cops.
Well, we don't know this at the time. It starts off like that, but then it also then quickly pans to a small, tiny room of folding chairs, and it seems to be honouring something else at the same time.
They're honouring the lady that came forward to the police.
Glenda Cleveland.
Glenda, yeah. But they're also honouring the police that failed the city.
Yeah. So, you're right. Glenda gets like a Citizen's Merit Award, but she states that she's only accepting it on the proviso that the police do better. Like, don't let this happen again. This is what she said when she accepted it and just kind of walks out.
And then
you go back to this like lavish scene of meal and the big police do. The Milwaukee Police Association Officer of the Year Award. And it's the two officers who took Conorak back to Dharma that are being awarded it.
Took a victim back to Dharma. Yeah, it was horrific.
Yeah.
Absolutely horrific. And it's a brilliant scene. It's probably one of the best scenes of the episode. The kind of parallel edit between the two scenes. It's incredible. And obviously, there might be some kind of creative license there. It'd be a big surprise if two things happened exactly the same time, but the way it's portrayed is incredible. It's very effective.
I subsequently found out that Milwaukee is actually one of the most, at the time especially, was one of the most segregated cities. So the communities do live very, very separately, and so there is a lot of racial tension within
it. So it's represented pretty well that way.
Yeah. I think we don't see it here, that the police are very different in this country. They are, it's like a club in America.
Yeah.
It's frightening how much power they have in certain places, the corruption that there is there, the internal, I suppose, favouritisms. It's actually straight after this scene that you see Glenda's neighbours gathering downstairs in their blankets and things like that because they need to comfort each other because they're very isolated in themselves.
The hallway.
They can't be in their own apartments.
Yeah.
They have to create their community that way. You know, the police seem to be a community of themselves.
And what happens to the apartments? What happens to Glenda in this episode? Is it not this episode?
I think it might be in the next one.
I think we can kind of, we can cross over a little bit between this episode and the next because it is the final two.
But this episode very much deals with actually the bogeyman, with Dharma being that devil incarnate.
The effect he's left behind.
Yeah. So, you know, it's Conrack's funeral as well. Glenda goes to that, you know, apologises to the dad. And, you know, Lionel visits his grandma. Sorry, Jeff's grandma, which is Lionel's mother.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a lot of, like, look at all these people that are really affected.
Yeah.
Even, like, the murder tourists.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
Oh, my God, yeah, the camera. And then Glenda's daughter gets affected and it gets arrested. And, just shocking, the whole thing.
Like
shocking.
How quickly the police came to arrest Glenda's daughter.
Yeah.
Because the white man was pressing charges because she smashed his camera because he was disgustingly taking pictures of, you know, the apartment and, like,
exactly,
you know, fanboying. It's this episode that you see that rich gentleman that buys all of Jeff's possessions.
That's right.
And he buries them.
He buries them and he makes sure that...
His name's Joe Zelba. And he gave a cheque for £32,000 to Mr. Synthesymphone. Oh, sorry, dollars. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Which all 11 families received. So, he gave the money. Basically, he paid, I think it was like $400,000 for all of Jeff's belongings because all of the funds were being split between the victim families.
So it couldn't be profited and people couldn't lust over something so dark, these dark objects.
Exactly. You also go to the survivors seeing Jeff in the club, don't you?
Yeah.
That, you know, the city do buy and demolish the apartment building within 60 days.
Wow.
Wow,
that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah. The episode ends with Jeff in a prison chapel with the group singing hymns, I think. It's kind of like all black men in this prison,
mm-hmm.
in the chapel. Jeff starts singing. You can kind of see somebody in the background. All of a sudden he approaches him and stabs him in the neck. You know, it's I don't know. There's a lot of emotion about this devil person, isn't it?
This is kind of the next step in the worship. Well, it's the worship period of this person.
Of him, yeah.
Yeah.
And that leads us then into episode 10, which is called God of Forgiveness, God of Vengeance. There's a lot of God, devil, that kind of iconography, symbolism.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
The episode, do you remember where the episode starts? Chicago, 1977.
I've forgotten what
takes
was the
you
scene?
Out completely.
What's the scene?
It's a young guy who's going for a job interview, pulls up in a van with a guy. John Wayne Gacy.
And the only way I recognise that is there's a scene. Did you recognise it before they went into the house? What was going on?
I just wasn't expecting it. Yeah, you see a picture of a clown.
So there's an unassuming scene in Chicago at the very beginning. And then there's a pan across the room. And you see a lit picture of a painting of a clown.
Mm.
And you and I both realised who this person was and who is this person we're seeing in the opening scene?
John Wayne Gacy.
And what's
one of his victims.
What's he kind of...
The clown killer.
The clown killer, yeah.
Yeah, so it's quite a detailed scene, really, of him meeting this a young man in a bar.
Yeah.
Drugs him, ties him up, he's got rosaries, he fights him. You know, it's really unpleasant.
He's a heavy set dude, isn't he?
Oh, he's just great. He's just so great.
So it's quite the you don't think the guy's going to survive, but because you know who this guy is.
Yeah.
But the way this runs alongside Dharma's existence and his is deeply terrifying.
Yeah.
Because this is happening. These serial killer, these murders are happening whilst he's in prison. 77.
No, this is before back in 77. So it's a flashback to him and who he is.
Yeah.
To, I suppose, to set the scene for those people who don't know him.
That's right, yeah.
And then you see the news with talking about Gacy's execution. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
And then you go back to Glenda again, who's at work. She's being really, like, candid, saying about... to a co-worker about what she smelled. Do you remember that scene where it's really uncomfortable?
She's gotten used to it now.
Yeah.
She can talk about it to anyone. But when someone else hears it for the first time, it's very, very raw for them.
Yeah. You then cut to Jeff in prison. He's in the food hall. He's ruffling feathers, isn't he, really? He's, like, goading people again.
He thinks he's bulletproof at this point.
Yeah, I don't think he is. Personally, I think he's just pushing buttons to try and... He's talking about his food and, like, I think this is where he says about, like, fingers or thumbs or something like that. And
oh, yeah, this doesn't taste like real flesh or human flesh.
Or something. And he's just being really crude. And he talks about selling his autograph and stuff. And then he's sat on his own, obviously, and then a Christian prisoner comes up to him, like this guy, and he says, "I've atoned for my sins," you know, and he feels as though Jeff has, like, zero remorse and finds his behaviour really offensive. We find out that his name is Mr. Scarver because he goes down to where, like, there's a library, isn't there? He's trying to do some research on Dharma.
So he, initially, he doesn't know who Dharma is. He just knows that
this
prisoner is pissing everyone off.
Because he's been in solitary. He's been in solitary confinement, for like a couple of months.
So the guy that does the research is in solitary and sees him in the food hall and doesn't realise...
Yeah, and everyone's talking about him. He's like, who is this guy?
Right.
He asked the librarian for information and the woman was like, you know, you need to be careful. Because we find out during this point that he thought that processed food was causing him to have psychotic breaks. And the woman's like, you know, I don't think you should be really looking into it. He's like, no, I'm fine now. It's like just this guy who's wanting to find out a bit more about him.
What's this guy's psychological background? He's a, psychotic, isn't he?
Yeah, he's schizophrenic. We don't really know that much about him in this programme, I'll be honest with you.
No, not at all, no.
You then cut to Jeff with the priest. So Jeff's asking the priest, why are there so many people like him, like serial killers? I think this is when the priest says, you know, maybe it's war, maybe it's absent fathers or pornography or, you know, just the highway. So having access to, like, the routes and stuff like that to escape. And then Jeff saying that he dressed up as a devil as a child and he felt good about that. He made an altar to the devil and saved the body parts. You know, he likes the bad guys more in movies. Jeff asks the priest about Gacy, and who doesn't actually admit to what he did at all. He fights it a lot. You know, the priest talks about Gacy, and it's just a weird interaction how Jeff completely, wholly admitted to everything that he did.
Yeah.
And Gacy didn't. There's the complete opposites of... Most serial killers don't really admit to it as freely as Jeff did, but I don't think Jeff really understood that he was a serial killer.
Is this the point where he asks for something from the priest?
I don't know.
You know what I mean? The procedure in the... prison.
I don't think it is.
You know what I mean? I don't want to say it openly now. What?
But you go from this priest to Glenda talking to a priest as well. Again, it's, you know, it's that God and it's all about that. Lionel visits Jeff in prison. Yeah. And Jeff says it's at this point that you realise that Jeff's on Prozac now. And then he tells Dad that he misses booze every day.
Yeah.
But he tells his dad he wants to get baptised.
That's right, yeah. He wants
and
to
Lionel's
baptized,
delighted
yeah.
to. It was actually when he was telling his dad that we find out. And Lionel, you know, Jeff is asking Lionel if he could ever forgive him.
He's never stopped loving his son, has he?
He said he would, he does, he has, because he, you know, he's his son.
Yeah.
Lionel says that in his book, he tried to, the reason that he wanted to write this book, he wanted to help other parents and children this. But then you cut to then the scene of Mr. Syntha Symphone and Glenda at his son's wedding.
Yeah. Isn't that a great scene? The setting and everything. You think it's time to rejoice and have a special moment, but the father can't ever forget and he can't ever move on, can he?
No. And he's in so much despair that he has a shot of whiskey.
Yeah. Ooh. Yeah, who drinks whiskey and shots? Ugh, grim, yeah.
And gives one to Glenda as well, because Glenda's there.
Yeah.
There is like this, you know, Dharma, devil versus Jesus feeling. Mm. That's what I got out of it. It's just, you know, the mothers of the victims gather together and they talk about, you know, that it's not winning, is it really?
That's right, yeah. Well, there is no winning for anyone, really. There isn't. The only winning is getting him off the streets. That's the small kind of win here.
Yeah.
Everything else is.
It could have been done so earlier.
Exactly.
That's the problem.
Oh, my God, yeah.
Jeff does have the baptism, and it's the same day as Gacy's execution, which made
and that's a real thing, isn't it? Yeah. It's exactly the same day.
He found God.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
And I think it's a few months later, so it's still the same year. He's on work duty cleaning the gym. A prison officer gets Mr. Scarver and leaves him with a friend that Jeff has who does the same work as him called Jesse. And you hear, on the programme, you hear Jesse being hurt in a locker room.
Yeah. Really badly. We don't see anything, but there's a metal pole dripping with blood, isn't there, when he comes back into the gym?
Yeah, and he said, you know, Mr. Scarver says that Jesse killed his wife and blamed two black guys for it.
Yeah.
And then he was telling Jeff basically what he did, like you were eating the flesh and like a 15-year-old boy and all that. Jeff didn't deny any of it, and he said he was lost but returned to God, and now he's changed. Scarver believes in God too and believes in vengeance, and he says that the Lord spoke to him and asked him to punish Jeff.
That's right, yeah, the vengeance.
And God's wrath always catches up on you, and that Mr. Scarver was God's vessel. The montage of him killing Jeff is pretty full on.
The whole thing's full on, but that scene is really dark, and the reveal of, because basically he's murdered in this cell, there's no kind of spoilers, but when you see out of focus what's happened to his head later on, when
Lionel goes to hospital,
he does come to identify the body, but he comes to see his son's body, and it's absolutely brutal what's happened.
You know, after sitting with the material and thinking about it for a while, it is really just bizarrely ironic that he gets killed by, you know, a weight, like the barbell for a weight,
and his
first victim was killed by
The weight itself, right? Okay, yeah. I forgot that. That's great. Well, it's interesting to the way that's kind of bookended.
It's just
you
then go into Joyce Flint, so Jeff's mum arrives. There's a lot of discussion about the autopsy.
And what is it that
the brain was removed to determine the cause of death, and the scientist wants to experiment on the brain at the New University of Wisconsin. But Jeff wanted to be cremated, so Lionel says no, but Joyce is saying yes. So they had a court hearing about this.
Yeah.
And the judge ruled that there needs to be closure on this matter, and so the brain was destroyed. The final scenes are Glenda at the Park Memorial. A city representative says a lot of people don't want to build anything on the lot, that they want to forget about it. But Glenda wanted a memorial. but there actually is no memorial on Oxford Park apartment site, and it kind of just ends like that.
Yeah.
Doesn't it?
It makes sense. I understand a memorial, but a memorial for victims will... It's a tricky one, really. Do you have a memorial for victims every turn? I know on the point, because it'll become a point of cult status for those Dharma followers, a focal point. So if you do destroy and wipe it off the face of the earth, your apartment block at very least, there is no symbol, there is no place for those people to gather. There's nothing for them to gather around. So there's certain points I agree with not doing the memorial, but I understand her thinking as well.
But they're probably not doing it because they don't want to spend money on doing it for people
exactly,
they
yeah.
don't care about, because that, you know, that's the implication that
yeah.
we feel.
That's right.
So, you know, just to summarise, really, the whole thing is just such a terrible tragedy for the victims, including Glenda and the families. You know, that can't be minimised at all.
No, that's what this show's really about.
It is. But I do feel an empathy for Jeff as well. He was so alone and abandoned for so long. You know, his brother David was born when he was 6. You know, his mum cared for him and left Jeff. Literally left Jeff alone. Yeah. The dad was away working a lot. You know, Jeff's lawyer?
Yeah.
Jeff's lawyer had a female assistant, and they recorded a lot of Jeff's tape. There's tapes of Jeff talking about okay. his life and his crimes and everything to this young female lawyer, who kind of, you know, you have to a certain degree befriend somebody in order to get their trust, to gain their trust so that they can open up to you.
Yeah.
And Jeff was promised like a lot of cigarettes and coffee just to stay there and talk, and when you're in prison that's kind of great,
like gold for him.
Yeah. So, and obviously there was a lot of, you know, information gathering for the court case as well, mm-hmm. and to defend him. So he stated within these tapes that he realized that he was gay at the age of 13. He felt really distant and different to everyone around him. You know, his first sexual fantasies were of control and dominance at the age of 18.
Mm-hmm.
That's when he was drawn to that jogger.
Okay.
And he wanted to knock him unconscious and just to touch and cuddle and explore the body in the woods. But the jogger didn't run that path on the day that he actually prepared a weapon, like a bat or something. And he was laying in wait, but the fantasy started to become a reality on that day. And so he was going to kill that person.
Yeah.
You know, his parents separated in 1978. He was 18. He tried to find happiness in his own way.
Yeah.
On his own. But he was alone. Lionel didn't know that Joyce had left him. And Jeff didn't talk to her ever again. You know, he got depressed and lonely and bored and confused. This is what Jeff is saying. You know, in 3 weeks after you graduated high school was actually when he found the hitchhiker Stephen Hicks on the streets without his shirt on, which is what he'd been fantasizing for so long.
Yeah.
That physically fit man.
The guy that was going to the concert.
Without a shirt on.
Yeah.
You know, Jeff thought that the opportunity was too good for him not to lure, control and enact his fantasies. He said he was excited and fearful all at the same time. Psychologists have deemed him, he is a necrophilia. Drank too much. He went to university, actually. So he killed his first before he even went to university. He went to university for 3 months, but he drank too much and he failed, basically. So then Dad enrolled him in the army.
Oh, wow.
As he was a field medic training, as he was doing his training, he learned about the organs and body parts.
Wow.
He was discharged due to heavy drinking, and he returned to the house, the family home, 3 years later. Steve Hicks' body was still in bags at the house when he returned. So he spread out his remains in the woods when he got back from his army.
Jesus Christ, that's incredible. That's insane.
Yeah, so Jeff said that he felt troubled by the killing. He actually felt real guilt. He knew it was wrong. He didn't want anything like that to happen again. He knew he was warped in his thinking. It wasn't until 13 years later that Stephen's family were informed of his death.
Jesus.
So he moved to Wisconsin, so from Ohio, which is his family's home, to Wisconsin with his grandma to help her, actually. It was to help her in 1981. He loved her, and she loved him. You know, he actually couldn't have any meaningful relationships because he was at his grandma's house and the grandma didn't know he was gay, so he started going to church regularly with his grandma.
Okay.
And he wanted to eradicate these sinful thoughts and stifle his preferences and urges.
Wow, I didn't know that.
I know.
They didn't put any of that on the show, no.
This is why he found that mannequin.
Yeah.
He tried to avoid his urges.
And, with something that's like...
And he avoided alcohol as well. Wow. So it was at that time that he thought that he would be, you know, satiated with this mannequin.
Yeah.
While he was at the library, he was actually sitting and reading, and a guy gave him a note offering him a blowjob in the toilet, and he said that this really triggered him and his urges again, and he thought he could easily get away with gay sex if he wanted it. He was really that easy.
Wow.
So, because he was working at...
Is this all in the tapes?
Yeah. Because he was working at the chocolate factory at night, he had halcyon to help him sleep, which is what he used on his hookups at the bathhouses. So it started at the bathhouses where
that's
he...
That's right, yeah.
So he would use the medication that he was given so he could control and do what he wanted without to them while they were passed out.
Yeah.
And because he just wanted to lay with them. He wanted to do things to them and he didn't want things to be done to him. Remember the police were called for that one overdose guy?
That's right, yeah.
But at that point then he was a marked man and he wasn't questioned for rape, assault, disorderly conduct. Police failed the gay community massively, but all the bathhouses told him that he couldn't go back.
Wow. Yeah, there's a failure in the system in several different spots throughout this entire story.
And it wasn't until November the 10th in 1987, 9 years after Stephen Hicks, that he picked up Stephen Toomey. And Jeff went to a hotel after a night out and he woke up with Stephen dead.
Oh, yeah. Because he doesn't remember.
Jeff completely blacked out.
That's right, yeah.
He didn't know what happened. It wasn't planned. And he said it opened the floodgates to his urges and fantasies that he tried to suppress for so long. He tried to stop himself. He had it's like he had a religious conversion in reverse. He watched movies that focused on the devil and mind control. Star Wars, the Emperor he identified with, he got yellow contacts to be like him. He put them in before he went out to charge himself up.
Wow, because of Star Wars.
Yeah. He was doing in reality what is portrayed in movies.
Wow, that's incredible.
You know, we really need to, you know, highlight the fact that there were 15 men and 2 children that were killed by Dharma. So there were 15 men and 2 children killed by Dharma. I think it's important for us to name them, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, go right ahead.
So we have Stephen Mark Hicks, who was 18. Stephen Walter Tuomi, who was 25. James Edward Dox Tater, who was actually 14. He was the Native American. In the program, he was portrayed much older than that, but he was 14. Richard Guerrero was 22. Anthony Sears was 24. Raymond Smith was 32. He was also known as Ricky Beaks. Edward Smith was 27. Ernest Miller was 22. David Thomas was 22. Curtis Strauter was 17. Errol Lindsay, 19. Tony Hughes was 31. Conorak Synthesumphone was 14. Matt Turner was 20. Jeremiah Weinberger was 23. Oliver Lacey was 24 and Joseph Bradhoft was 25. Tracy Edwards was the survivor that alerted the police and took them to Jeffrey's flat. And if it wasn't for his courage, he wouldn't have been caught that day. And the terror wouldn't have stopped.